Sail away.
Okay.
Sorry, Chair Brennigan, just loading this.
Oh, yeah, pardon me. Gotta get the recording going.
Okay, we're set, thanks.
We're set, okay. Okay, the regular session of February 26th is started at 7:20. And first item up is the roll call. John Updike.
Here.
Harry.
Here.
Bob.
Here.
Bill, here.
I'm here.
Rolio.
Here.
And Marjorie.
Here.
Okay. All present and accounted for. First order of business is the approval of the minutes. Do we have a motion to approve the minutes or any additions?
Oh, sure. I looked at them. I didn't look at them in detail, but I certainly didn't review the video. But
they look fine to me.
Okay, well then make a motion.
I would move approval of 2:12, regular and work session minutes.
I'll second.
Oh, okay. It's okay.
Okay.
Cold in here.
Motion made and the second.
I don't think we had a work session.
Actually, you're right. I'm seeing two lines, but there's only, it's just regular session.
Regular session.
My apologies.
There was no work session.
Okay, so we have a motion to approve the minutes for the regular.
I'll session that. I'll second that.
And we have a seconded. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? None. Approved. Okay. Moves us up to the citizens and public comment. We have anybody, Sherry?
We do not, thanks.
We do not. So assuming there's nobody here, can we amend or can we omit the reading of the?
Eric?
Of the.
No, you got to go through and just go through it.
Skip the Zoom part.
You can skip the Zoom part because you have no audience in attendance that, but.
We can just push the play button.
That'd be an idea.
Yeah, he'll get to the action item.
Okay, quasi-judicial legislative land use public hearings. We have a final order and finding for a conditional use permit on file number 1-CUP-24. The statement applies to quasi-judicial and legislative land use hearings on the agenda. All testimony and evidence presented toward the request being heard must be directed toward the applicable criteria and the Newport Comprehensive Plan, Newport Municipal Code, or other land use regulations or standards which the speaker believes to apply to the decision. The failure of anyone to raise an issue accompanied by statements or evidence sufficient to afford the Planning Commission and the parties an opportunity to respond to the issue will preclude appeal to the Land Use Board of Appeals based on that issue. An issue which may be the basis for an appeal to the Land Use Board of Appeals shall be raised not later than the close of the record at or following this evidentiary hearing. Such issue shall be raised and accompanied by statements or evidence sufficient to afford the city decision makers and the parties an adequate opportunity to respond to each issue. The failure of the applicant to raise constitutional or other issues relating to proposed conditions of approval with sufficient specificity to allow the city to respond to the issue precludes an action for damages in circuit court. Prior to the conclusion of a hearing, any participant may request an opportunity to present additional evidence, arguments, or testimony regarding the application. If such a request is made, then the hearing will be continued to a date certain and schedule set for submittal of additional testimony, a period for parties to respond to the new testimony, and a period whereby the applicant can provide final argument. At this time, I would ask planning commissioners to disclose any actual or potential conflicts of interest, bias, ex parte contacts, or site visits.
I live in a house.
Okay, hearing.
We're talking about housing.
Ditto.
Very well.
Okay, hearing done. Then there's nobody out there to object to the participation of any planning commission member or the commission as a whole. The planning commission may, at the request of a participant or on its own accord, continue the hearing to a date certain to provide an opportunity for persons to present and rebut new evidence, arguments, or testimony related to the applicable criteria. And there's a little thing here on the hearing will proceed in the following order, but we're really not having a hearing. It's a final order, so.
Derek, were we gonna?
Yeah, we just haven't gotten to it yet. We'll get a.
I'm willing to take a stab at it.
Sure, sure.
Send me an electronic document.
Yeah, I'll catch up with you offline. I've got a legislative template that already, that okay. Maybe we can pass back and forth and get that hammered out.
Okay. Right. Yes, Bob.
I move under action items. I move that we approve file 1-CUP-24, final order and findings, as approved at the previous meeting.
I second.
Any discussion? I'm not hearing any. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none. The file number 1-CUP-24 is approved. Which brings us up to file number 3-Z-23, amendments related to the implementation of the city's housing production strategy to reduce code barriers for housing development. The staff report.
Thank you. And I've put up a copy of the amendments, and I want to make sure specifically to cover any of them that I've highlighted, because they're ones that you didn't happen to have a chance to talk about at your work sessions. This again is a package of changes to implement the housing production strategy recommendation to reduce code barriers for housing development. There are a number of code barriers that potential code barriers that were listed. You've had a chance to look at code on that at a couple of different work sessions. These amendments touch on, they're exclusive to the zoning ordinance, and they touch on chapters 1403, 1406, 1411, 1413, 1414, 1433, and 1452 of Title 14 of the Municipal Code, which is our zoning ordinance. So I'm just gonna go through them here. You did receive some comment from Cheryl Connell. I pass it along to you. I actually did incorporate that change into this.
And yeah, I'll show you that.
That's it.
We talked about maybe global effort in that respect to make sure that we're consistent throughout the code. I know that's a time consuming and a,
right.
And, you know, but maybe should go on a to-do list somewhere.
Okay, thank you. Yep. As a code, just kind of a code cleanup kind of item.
Yeah.
Picking up items.
Yeah.
Before I forget, let me just chop that down. Housekeeping item. All right. First one is actually an item I added in as I was putting together materials for the council on the affordable housing excise tax that you made a recommendation on in November. I was finally able to get a work session with the council on that item at their last meeting and went through that and recognized that, you know, we have the same affordable housing definition in chapters 3 and 14, and you had made a recommendation in chapter 3 to clarify that language. And I want to make sure then it gets added to chapter 14 as well in the same manner. So that's what this is. This is the sentence structure is slightly different, but this is the same amendment that you recommended in November be clarified in the same definition that sits in chapter 3, which deals with the excise tax. And so again, that's at least half of the units on the property are made available to own or rent, just like the one above, to families with incomes of 60% or less of the area median income, and just like the one above, as determined by the Housing Stability Council. Then moving along, here's where the transitional housing gets added, and then the footnote is where I picked it up from Cheryl Connell's comment. So that no longer refers to, in the highlight there, month, but actually refers to not more than 30 days.
Where is nonprofit entity defined? I know they're 501c3, that's what we all think of as nonprofits, but there's all kinds of political groups and churches, and they all...
We would look to statutory definitions for what qualifies as nonprofit.
So there is one.
There are, yes.
Okay.
There are a range of there are a range of types of nonprofits.
Right.
But that falls within what the state recognizes, yeah. Okay. That's where we'd go.
All right.
And the RV, this is the one where I ended up having to spend a fair amount of time just to reflect what we had discussed, because we'd gone through this in some detail, but I had to put the code piece in. So, you know, building permit shall be obtained, demonstrating that RV park satisfies the requirements of Chapter 19, Division 650 of the Administrative Rules. Remember, this prior code was drafted decades ago in the 80s when the process was different. And the state had a much more hands-on role in reviewing and approving RV parks. They have one person now. I managed to get a hold of him. He's the legacy person, I think. I referred to his name specifically in here. Yeah, Richard Bowman. With the Building Codes Division, we had a good discussion, walked through a bunch of this stuff. And so they're really, the administrative rules, the appropriate reference here. We can be specific. We don't have to be vague, and that's what the prior language was, vague and not very helpful.
On the RV thing, we have in there that we should have a 30-gallon trash receptacle for every four sites.
But farther on down.
Farther on down.
Okay.
Yeah.
Instead of 30 gallons, we put in 65-gallon container. That's the big container. I mean, 30 gallons is pretty small, and people in RVs
have a lot of trash.
They generate a lot of trash.
Yeah. Accumulated over time.
Well, yeah.
Well, they bring it from home.
Yeah, they bring it from home, and they eat out a lot and all the rest of it. I mean, 30 gallons is, you know.
For four units, is that what we're talking about?
Yes, for four units.
I could see an expansion might be called for.
Talk about that when we hit that section, because you had asked for some coordination with Thompson's too. Is that
right?
Yeah, certainly.
This section B, where it used to say the developer of the park obtained a permit from the state, and there's no state permit to obtain. That's how old that language is.
Oh.
It's been repurposed to require that they obtain verification from the county, basically county health, that the park will satisfy the Oregon Health Authority rules. That's the other party at the state level that has administrative rules that apply to RV parks. And they're looking at it from a sanitation perspective, not a construction perspective. Then for C, the developer provides a plan of the proposed park that contains the following, and I pulled in the administrative rule stuff here so that they don't have to go to the administrative rules to get that information.
That's also handy for staff.
Yeah, it is.
You can just point, this is what it says.
The only difference in the language I have here that's in the administrative rule is I pulled out the campground stuff, because this is not a campground code. We're dealing with an RV park. So where it referenced campground specific stuff, I pulled that out. And this is all pretty straightforward stuff that you would need to be able to adequately evaluate, you know, park, you know, in terms of does it have a, you know, appropriate facilities and services. The 400 square feet versus the 600 square feet, that's what you had agreed to, reduce the, that's the minimum size of your RV pad sites. The roadway standards.
I'd like to discuss that if you could.
I would too.
Sure.
I did not attend this meeting physically. I attended this meeting via Zoom. And when I think of an RV park, I think of the facility up in Agate Beach. I think of the other RV park just south of town. I think of maybe sometimes the state parks. You seem to suggest in your presentation that an RV park would include the, what I would call the manufactured home park near the high school on First Street. And you said, you, if I recall your statements, Derek, you were suggesting that the roadways and the pads didn't need to be paved because people are living and we're going to make it affordable by lowering the standards of, it would be cheaper to have, say, a paved, a gravel street rather than a paved street or a paved pad. So I thought about that. And then there were a couple of our folks here who are RVers. And it was, I thought it was important for me to listen to those folks who actually do have RVs and do actually use them and to get their insight into what they thought would be appropriate. So I'd like to remember if we could have maybe a brief discussion on that issue. Well, you talked about RVing.
Most of the parks that I attend or have go to on a regular basis, most of them do not have paved roads. They're all gravel.
Okay.
All the pads are gravel. They're well maintained. I mean, there's, you know, there's lots of landscaping area and the parks are nice, but again, I've never found that having, you know, a paved road or paved pads to inhibit my enjoying a park, as long as it has the facilities to back up their capacity. I don't really think that having paved roads or having paved pads is really should be mandated for park, as long as they cover, you know, bathrooms and showers, as long as they have enough facilities to accommodate the amount of the
You're
amount
suggesting
of pads
maintenance
they have
is,
there.
Is more important than the materials used for the roadways or the pads.
Yeah. So the parks. A lot of the parks that go, not so much in the winter, but in the summertime, they do have water trucks and things that they run down the roads to keep the dust down on the main roads that get traveled a lot. But most of them are graveled well enough to where there really isn't any huge dust problems. And if there is, most of the parks I've been in are pretty good about taking care of those areas that do cause dust. So I don't think that should be mandated for a park to come in and, you know, forcing them to do paved roads and do concrete pads, because that is extremely expensive. Mm-hmm. Unless it's a really, really high-end private park, then, you know, it's...
They'll do that anyway at that point.
They'll do it anyway at that point, yeah. Yeah. So.
And I agree.
I think your insights helped me remove objection to the draft that was presented, you know?
I tend to agree. I've been RVing for about 50 years now.
Uh-huh.
Oh my God, it's hard to say stuff like that. But, you know, there's almost, we're almost talking about two groups of people. One, tourists who look up their RV and go places, as you and I do.
Yep.
And then we're also trying to address the situation where people are essentially permanent resident, full-timers at the park. And I think in either of those cases, unless the maintenance is a problem, that there really isn't any real reason to have pavement, especially if we can encourage additional parks to accommodate more full-time people that live there. The only time I've seen a problem is with gravel that was not properly maintained in a place that gets a lot of rain. You can have some incredible ruts and mud puddles and even stepping out of your RV into the mud. But if I run across a place like that, I don't go back.
Are you familiar with either the RV park in the north end of town or the one?
Well, I know.
Lost Creek.
Where?
There's another RV park just south of Lost Creek.
You're talking about the Thousand Trails?
I think
on 123rd?
Do those either of those facilities have full-time residents, or are those truly transients?
They are basically they're run as a timeshare type situation. Uh-huh. So you do not have you do have spots that are designated for more long-term campers. In other words, they're seasonal, and they actually leave an RV there, and they come in. They kind of run it as a timeshare, so they're there for 3 or 4 months at a time. You know, they're there seasonally. But that's very, very few sites. There's a few depending on when you bought your membership. So they were offered a little bit more permanent type residence there. They can't stay there all year round. They can only stay there for so long, and then they have to vacate for a certain period of time. But for the most part, people are in there for, I think, a max of 2 weeks at a time, and then they have to move to the next park, or they have to be
and those kind to of a different people site. Can be selective. You know, if they don't like their experience in that week or two, or in my case, it's usually 3 nights. Uh-huh. You just don't go back. The audience we're trying to address here are people that want to set up that kind of facility to help accommodate people full-time housing. And there the criteria, you know, could be slightly different, but I still don't see a problem with gravel, but so potentially a problem with maintenance.
With the draft that we're
this draft is fine.
This draft is fine. Yeah, as long as, there's a lot of other services that would be much more important than gravel driveways and gravel pads. Mm-hmm. That would
like garbage cans.
Power and water to the sites, to selected sites, and or sewer to the
cable
sites.
Cable TV, internet service. You know.
Well, yeah. That
I'd like to thank both of you. Help me. Yeah. Formulate, a good response. Thank you.
Okay. So this language reflects what we had discussed last time, which rolls in and gives the option of going gravel. The dimensional requirements align with the administrative rule, which tended to be stricter than what our code was in terms of the parking requirements.
I'm a little concerned about number two, where you have two-way traffic on the roads in the RV park, and we apparently reduced it to 20 feet wide. And I suspect that two fire trucks cannot pass each other going opposite directions. Minimum street here, and talking to the fire marshal ages ago at one of these meetings, I live on a substandard street, I believe is what they're called, where it's got a width of 24 feet. And the fire chief said, yes, we can do 24, but we don't like smaller. That's what he said, and this is a safety issue. So we reduced it apparently from 30 to 20. Seems to me that we could have reduced it to 25. Fire trucks are at least 10 feet wide. If one is parked, and it has its stabilizers out, it's now much wider than 10 feet wide. And if one has to pass, it ain't going to happen. Again, it's safety. Something is on fire, and people are trying to evacuate. So I think 20 is not a very safe standard. That's only my opinion, but I don't know. I've been trained in severe safety precautions, too.
I will say in development scenarios in both Tucson and in San Francisco that I've had to manage, 20 has always been the acceptable. Can't go to 19. but we can go to 20. And that's for any type of fire apparatus you can think of. So those are urban environments, alley environments, you know, from Chinatown to downtown.
Yeah,
20 seems to be like a national.
Is that addressing two-way traffic, or are you talking about a single?
Two-way.
Two-way, yeah. And our fire department's not going to have an issue with this. They, where they run into an issue now, and they've clarified this over the years, Jim, because they've taken different positions over the time, but if it's multifamily, they need it wider because they have a ladder truck, and the deployment of the ladder truck's a little bit different.
True.
At least where they set that up, because it's got, it kicks out on the sides to stabilize it, and they ask for a little bit more in that. But typically, just for any, and they wouldn't ask for, obviously, we don't have multifamily in the RV parks. 20 feet is fine. They have, we have that also baked into our, what is it, our yield streets that we adopted, the shared streets. Those have a 16-foot, the smallest we have is a 12-foot paved section with 4-foot shoulders on each side to ensure you have 20 feet of clear area. So that's where they default to John's point, is 20 feet cleared area. The way this is set up, that 20 feet is not for parking. You have additional requirements for the parking bays. That throws another 10 feet on either side, depending on what you're up to. So if you want parking on both sides, now you're 40 feet of width. That's quite a bit of width.
Well, I'm not interested in parking. I'm interested in fire trucks, ambulances, right, and the like going two ways on a street trying to save people. You guys can, you know, do what you want. But for me, that's
25 feet.
I would think 25 feet is, I'd like to see that extra 5 feet. It's not going to cost, I mean, yes, it will cost the developer. He's going to lose some of his area that he could cram in another RV, because that's how these places work. But I think when you put safety second or third or fourth, you're making a big mistake, because you're dealing with human life. But, of course, there's 8 billion of us, so maybe we're not all that valuable.
Well, I just want to be clear. What our local street standard calls for 10-foot travel lanes, so two-way we're at 20 feet. If you want, so that's what we have all over the city in terms of our standard. Now, we get wider when we have parking on the side of a street. That's when we have, you know, our typical local street has 2 10-foot travel lanes, and 8-foot bays on either side if you want parking on both sides.
Well, I do know that 2 weeks ago during the ice storm, when the power crews came in to put lines back up on my 24-foot street, we could not pass traffic. That's with one line rig, one A rig, sitting on the road with stabilizers out. You could not get cars past it. So that's my argument. Do what you want.
I would like to solicit an opinion from the fire chief. I would like to leave it up to him as to whether the 20 stays or if he wants more, increase it to what he is comfortable with.
If you're comfortable with it, I would say pass the recommendation on to the city council to proceed with it. But ask that there be a favorable opinion from the fire chief to go with that standard.
Why don't we defer this and have the fire chief come, and then we could hear and then incorporate the group's decision after getting the input from the expert into the document.
Well, that's why I shared his opinion from a couple years ago when he was in here speaking about the safety.
He was also talking about it when we were talking about Wilder.
We did talk about Wilder, but in that discussion, because there were narrow streets there, the street I lived on came up because it was a practical application of safety. And he said, 24 feet, I can do that. I wouldn't like to see it narrower.
Is your street, it doesn't have parking then, so I'm just envisioning going to this mobile home park and somebody's coming this way, and I'm going this way, and there's no parking.
There are projects that would like to take advantage of some of the standards in here. We've got an apartment project, for example, that's holding off on submitting for building permits until the height issue is taken care of. So delaying this does have an impact. My, You can do that. You absolutely can do that if a majority of you want to delay this and bring the fire chief in here and have the fire chief confirm what I just told you he's going to say. Or if it's that narrow of a targeted issue, what you can do is say, we'll pass this along, but we want the fire chief to weigh in officially at the council level in concurrence with the standard, and if it's an alternative standard, we want that considered.
The input from the fire chief would help us with ongoing issues that would arise. And I don't think the world's going to end if we delay this for 2 weeks until our next meeting, if we just invite the fire chief to come in, if he'd like to come in.
You can. That standard is already in the administrative rule. We're not making up something. The two 10-foot travel lanes is in the OAR right now as the requirement for the travel lane stuff. You know, we're not, I wasn't making stuff up here. I was just rolling in what's in an existing administrative rule.
Why was 30 feet in there previously if we already had an administrative rule of 20 feet?
Ours was a bit convoluted with respect to what all can occur there. We have, the parking wasn't exactly clear. You know, the state administrative rule actually is more clear with respect to how it handles parking, you know, in terms of the interplay between travel lanes and parking.
So this is consistent with everything else, is what?
That is absolutely consistent with the administrative rule.
Administrative rule.
The Oregon administrative rule that spells out what the roadway standards are for RV parks.
What's the OAR?
That's.
Look it up.
You have it attached in here. It's attached in your packet.
Just so everybody knows, I looked up from the Fire Apparatus Manufacturers Association, the width of a standard pumper truck is 8 to 9 feet, not 10 feet.
Coincidentally, it's just about the same as the width of an RV. I mean, an RV, a motorhome.
Yeah.
In most RV parks, they're all one-way traffic anyway. They don't allow, very, very few that I've ever been into allow any two-way traffic. And the ones that do usually have quite a bit more than 20-foot roads.
So it's in your packet here.
If that helps any, but like
it's on, it's on page 50.
We're addressing
50.
Two-way traffic here, whether they have it or not. Some do, and the standard should be clear. If they already have more than 20 feet, then it would be little difficulty for them or us to raise this from 20 to 25 feet.
But we should be consistent with all our other.
Well, then we shouldn't be discussing. We shouldn't have ever had 30 in there, should we?
Probably not.
Well, we're dealing with, remember, we're cleaning up a 1980s code.
Right.
Well, that's fine, but the point is, it was 30 feet, and now we've made a jump to 20 feet, and we're going on what somebody somewhere between 1980 and now has decided 30 feet was too much, 20 feet is plenty.
The administrative rules, I believe, date to 2002 or so, something, but there have been some amendments. So they're listed. But again, on page 50 of your hard packet is where the general construction requirements are listed, and they specifically spell out street widths under sub 4. So it's OAR 918-650-0045 sub 4.
Well, the wider the street...
Yeah, it just says 20 feet minimum, so...
The wider the streets in an RV park, the less RV slots you're going to have, which impacts the business. The business makes, you know, the more sites they have, the more money they can make. So if you make the road 100 feet wide, you know, you're not going to have an RV park.
It would limit the depth of the sites.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, most sites are anywhere from 40 to 50 foot deep.
Well, lots of RVs are
45 foot.
45 foot.
Dropping 45-foot RVs aren't gonna fit in this place that only has 400 square feet.
Well, that's true too.
So if you go, I'm gonna bring it right to that standard in the administrative rule, which is in your packet.
What's the length of the fire truck? Not longer than that? It seems like 40.
Well, fire trucks? No, they aren't that long.
Depends on whether it's a ladder truck or.
Yeah, your standard tanker trucks are about 32 feet. Maybe not even quite that much.
So there's your requirement here. Oh, I gotta change, sorry. Stop sharing that. Sharing this.
Got me wondering what the width is where I live in a condo association.
Okay, so sub four.
Newport.
Yeah. It says 20 feet minimum.
It says each traffic lane must be 10 feet minimum width. All two-way streets without parking must be 20 feet minimum. Each parking lane must be 10 feet minimum width. That's what's in the administrative rule.
Standard. Is there any, I guess I'd ask our other folks, do we want to hear from the fire chief and all?
I would say
no. I don't think it's necessary.
Well, if it's an administrative rule, which one is going to hold?
Well,
that's a fire chief's opinion or an administrative rule.
The administrative rule is the minimum standard.
Yes, I understand.
That's the bottom line. Okay. I mean, that doesn't mean you can't have a greater level of safety.
I agree, but which one has greater expertise? That's my decision I have to make. Does the administrative rule have data to support that? Or does the fire chief have data to support his or her opinion? Which one is the expert?
But
that's my judgment I have to make.
Know our local community is my only thought. So.
Could you ask the fire chief if he saw any problem with that?
He's not gonna ask for it. I can say that with 100% confidence because he's been engaged with the development of, our fire department's been engaged with development of a lot of street standards. And this is the same as our local street standard that we have all over the place with two 10-foot travel lanes, and then you have your additional parking bays. This is no different than what we've put in the TSP and we've applied in many, many circumstances. So I know 100% confident fire chief is not going to say we need wider roads in RV parks than what this standard says. But if you want him to confirm that before this goes to council, I mean, sure, have the fire chief. You could say, hey, look, we have some concerns with this. We'd like the fire chief to confirm that's good.
He doesn't have to appear. He can simply
send a letter.
Yeah, he could.
But same for that purposes, you could just forward your assuming you don't have other issues, you could just forward your recommendation on to the council with the stipulation that you'd like to have something formal from the fire chief on the road width issue and that be considered by the council.
Fine.
I mean, that's
works
one way
for me.
Yeah.
That's not fine.
I just questioned 20 feet. That's all.
But he could personally say, I like the 24 feet, right? As
he could say many things. That's
the fire chief in town.
And at that point, it would be up to the council to say, should we leave it at 20, or should we listen to the chief and go 24?
Yeah,
and they make the change, and it's done.
And will the council give this issue the degree of scrutiny that this body is?
I have no idea.
No, not line by line. Absolutely not. But if we raise that as an issue, then they will focus on it.
Right, you're stipulating.
Why a two-week delay is meeting such resistance.
If there really is a permit, and I don't doubt Derek's word, is there somebody that would submit for a permit if this went into effect, then I would say time is of the essence. Two weeks may just be enough that guy says, you know, screw it, they're jerking me around, and go somewhere else. And I'd hate to see that happen because of something that is just, it could be settled at the next stage at the council, as Derek has suggested. I don't know whether 20 is right or not. I mean, this is a pretty good indication that that should be acceptable. But I would love to hear what the chief has to say, but I don't think waiting for that one sentence email is worth a 2-week delay in this whole process. If it's going to risk the possibility of us not having a development get done that was going to get done otherwise.
Well, then you also have to get it onto the city council's agenda.
Oh, it's probably already on, isn't it, Derek?
Well, now you're going to delay it, pull it off.
If you're going to provide a favorable recommendation, we would put this on the council's docket for the 18th of March, which would be their next available. And obviously, it's not going to be on next Monday. It has to be noticed. I mean, again, I mean, I don't want to come across flippant. I'm just saying, I mean, we have put standards in place in our TSP for what a local road width is, 2 10-foot travel lanes, 8-foot parking bays on the sides. We even have narrower sections for certain circumstances, the shared streets, the yield streets, the shared streets being as narrow as 12 feet of pavement with 4-foot shoulders, no parking, but 20 feet of cleared area. Fire department's been engaged in all of that stuff. This is consistent with a standard local street section. I mean, if we go wider, I mean, we're getting into collector roadway size at that point in terms of how wide it is.
And anybody that comes and develops, if they're been doing their homework, they're going to go, well, your standard is this. Why are you changing the standard for
this particular?
The challenge, too, we run into is because of the administrative rule, the way it's structured, we have to require 10-foot width in the parking, period, irrespective of what our street standard is.
Right.
So if we do 25 feet of street, we still got to require 10 feet on either side if they want parking on either side. Because the administrative rule, as you can see right there, speaks to the parking bay separate from the travel lanes.
It does.
And we can't go less than the administrative rule, even though our normal street standard is less than the administrative rule for parking. We don't require 10 feet of parking bays. 8 feet is what we require for on-street parking. On all the parallel areas you go, you add it up, you have an 8-foot for your parallel parking, and then you have a 10-foot travel lane. Those travel lanes only get bigger when you get into the collectors or the arterials where you got higher volumes of traffic.
So if they can't provide off-street parking in that 20-foot area, it's going to force the issue of them being able to having to increase the size of the street to accommodate any traffic anyway.
Well, at that point, they're probably going to go to one-way travel. And that may be why so many of your RV parks are one-way travel.
It could be.
I mean, there's always ways around or different solutions.
And you notice on one lane, we went higher, and that's because we codified one-way driveways in our municipal code as part of the TSP work at 12 feet, not 10. So the minimum width of a one-way drive, which our fire chief signed off on all the TSP stuff, which includes 10-foot typical travel lanes on a two-way and a 12-foot one-way as part of the we just adopted these standards a year ago on the 12-foot minimum width on a one-way driveway. That's in our code. Therefore, that's why I had that, not 10 feet, as provided here, which says each traffic lane must be 10 feet minimum width.
Well, but it's also interesting that when they talk about roadway size, they say 20 feet minimum.
For two-way.
Yes, but they use the word minimum.
Right.
So they see a baseline minimum.
Yep.
That doesn't necessarily mean they recommend that. They said that's the minimum it can be. So,
which maybe is what we say, not less than 20 feet. We're not saying you couldn't go bigger. You just can't go below.
I agree. I'm just saying that when you establish a minimum, that generally means that, well, I think that's the least amount you can have that function. That's what minimums are. Then you have maximums. It's like a prescription drug. We give you this dosage because this is the minimum dosage that will actually have efficacy.
Therapeutic effect.
Yes. But if you go beyond this maximum, then you have dangers of overdose or damage to some system. So we set minimums and maximums, and that gives us the guidelines. It doesn't mean that we always establish our standard at the minimum. But.
Well, I just think we
just need prefer to be, safety.
Yeah, well, I just think we need to be consistent with all the other rulings that are in the code that govern street sections.
So what I'm
We shouldn't be different for a mobile home park than we are for any other street section in town.
So what I'm hearing is that the majority of you are comfortable with this, and that you'd like, if you make a recommendation favorable, you'd like the fire chief to weigh in formally for the council, and that, that any comments fire chief has would be taken into consideration at the council level.
Yes.
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 Okay.
Right. There's a majority. I just keep us from beating that up anymore.
I did have a question. When we say stuff in here like imposed load of fire apparatus weighing up to 75,000, oh, designed in such that they are capable of supporting 75,000.
That's so the fire
trucks. Who checks that? No, I know what it's for. Checks that?
You know, what we would have is we actually have the project engineer do a compaction test and provide that report before they go to occupancy.
Okay, so that would be
that is something
resolved as part of the whole building permit and occupancy stuff.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually a common standard when you go outside of paved into the kind of the gravel kind of environment. You'll see that in the rural areas, you'll see a lot of that too. When you're putting in new access roads in forest land, for example, they have to be compacted to a certain level.
This is an interesting aside. The state of Oregon has a maximum width, together with many other states, on how wide any fire truck can be. And the maximum width is 102 inches. However, if you live in Michigan, you're exempt. It can be any as wide as you want.
That's why I'm familiar with 10 and 11 foot wide trucks. So it depends on where you live,
right?
Apparently. And not everybody not every jurisdiction believes that 8 feet is appropriate or 10 feet is appropriate. Right.
Arkansas is exempt, and Kansas, Michigan, Minnesota.
Yeah. We have bigger fires.
They go on the ice. They go on the ice. It could be as wide as they want.
So.
Rescue people.
So. That's wild. As an aside.
That's wild. Yeah.
Next place where there was new language is to address was under six, under solid waste. You had asked that there'd be a tie back to the standards we put in place with Thompson's, and that's what you see here with the reference to 14.11.060 B and C, which says, you know, your enclosure and access requirements have to comply with those, which were the new Thompson standards. Unless an alternative approach is approved in writing by the solid waste and recycling service provider, which is Thompson's, which is always the outlet. Then we get to the language, Bill, that you were talking about.
Yeah. Right.
Which was pulled out of the administrative rule. Again, that's you know, I mean, I'm more than happy to put in here that receptacles are to be provided at a rate of one 30-gallon container for each four RV spaces or as recommended by the service provider.
That would be good.
That would be good. I'm okay with that.
I can put that in there. I mean, Thompson's much better at that stuff.
Well, Thompson's, they have 30-gallon containers, 65-gallon containers, and then
they have
go
that giant one.
Yeah.
My neighbor has, I don't know what size that one is.
They have like a... Well, then it starts getting into dumpster size.
30-gallon ones, the smaller size.
Yeah, the little small green ones are the 30 gallons.
Derek, just be careful how you word that so it's not an either or.
No.
It's the greater of.
Okay, so unless a larger size is recommended. Yeah. Got it. All right, let's go here. All right. Toilets, lavatories, and showers reflects the table that was in the administrative rule, which I put into the code. That's what you're seeing right here. We had covered it in work session. You have to have so many toilets for so many parking spaces. It's an interesting corollary, but that's the way they do it.
All that stuff wouldn't be in the state RV code?
This is in the state code. We just pulled it over so that it's in one
because
spot. We pull it out of the administrative rule so it's all in one spot.
Just so it's easier.
It's convenience. This is an exact replica of what's in that table that's attached to the administrative rule. And then on 10, when we were talking about ventilation and lighting and all that, we agreed that that ought to be driven by what the Oregon Structural Specialty Code requirements are. We ought to not just be speculating in a land use code as to what that should be. And then I fixed the bad cross-reference on the subsections that has been in the code for 40 years. This gets its screening in 11, and what you said is you wanted to maintain screening requirements for parks that are in or adjacent to residential zoned areas, but we're okay without requiring the fences and the hedges if it's not, and so what this language gets at that. And again, this was, when you went through this exercise, the biggies that I caught that really would be cost savers, the reduction in the pad size requirement from 600 to 400 square feet, that was going to be very helpful for RV park people trying to get a number of pad sites in there. The agreeing to go with a gravel surfacing as opposed to pavement, that's a huge cost saver. And then this guy, this is a pretty significant cost, putting perimeter fencing and hedges up. And so you had agreed to, outside of, if it's not in a residential area, you were okay with dropping that.
Just occurred to me as you said that the 400 square feet is fine, but do we need somehow to specify that that's got to be at least 8 foot wide?
I think you're...
Or is it just, you know, nobody would do a 20 by 20?
Right. They're not going to set up their pad sites so they can't fit or accommodate a reasonable number of different RV options. And then this one, 12, was another biggie where you agreed to eliminate the requirement that there be no outside storage because outside storage goes kind of part. Everybody has to have some to a point. We have nuisance codes to deal with bad behavior. 13 got eliminated because it's not needed anymore. Again, that's that old code related to when they were getting actual certification of sanitation from the state, which didn't exist. I did carry over 12 here, which you hadn't. This is in our code elsewhere, which is each space within an RV park shall be provided a minimum of 50 square feet of outdoor area, landscaped or improved for rec purposes.
Yeah.
You probably remember dealing with that in the context of what was it, the OSU student housing that came up. Now, what I did put in here, I pulled out that it has to be enclosed. And that seems silly that the recreational area, you know, should be something that can be open. Why does it have to be fenced? And again, just in the trying to be in keeping these things reasonable. Well, it
would have to be enclosed, not covered.
No, it doesn't have to be.
It doesn't have to be enclosed, but it could be required to have a fence on one side if that's the edge of the property next to it.
Sure.
Yeah, okay.
But they don't have to enclose it. As a matter of course.
I can't think of an RV park that I've ever been to that had enclosed play, unless it was a swimming pool,
Right, yeah, you know, when, which case, you have some other standards that'll come into play for safety purposes, but I can't even think of a pool.
That's 50 square feet for the whole park?
Per slot.
Per slot.
Yeah, per site, so, which is what's in the current code. I didn't change that piece. I just pulled the enclosed aspect out of it.
5 by 8, huh?
That's the same provision.
Enough room for a couple more trips.
And then we're getting into the garage. Now we're out into the garage setback. We've talked about this. This was the garage setback piece was the language about your driveway. Your driveway has to be 20 feet in length, not from your property line, but from the edge basically of the roadway. And that's what this provides for. And we have that all over town.
Yeah. Yeah. Does this, if this passes,
yeah,
somebody has a conditional use permit, is there anything that's based on this, you know, like the guy up there on Spring Street? Does that permit go away or become null and void or?
No, anybody who has an existing conditional use permit that was approved under older rules that's still active stays active. I mean, they can come in and request modifications to it or authorization under a different set of standards and release from a conditional use permit. But oftentimes what you'll have with these conditional use permits is they developed in accordance with the conditional use permit and they're satisfied, in which case it just stays that way. Density limitations, I mean, again, this is stuff you've looked at work session. The 40-foot maximum height in the R3 and R4 zones for multifamily. The allowance for, you wanted a 412 or steeper instead of a 512 or steeper roof pitch.
Yep.
And that's what's in there now. You can see it right there. Yeah, we have two multifamily projects. We have Windhaven Phase 3 that's over 90 units, and then we have one that Ryan Bancroft is moving forward with, and he's working with AKS and Dustin, I believe, and that's off Southeast 35th. Those are the two that we anticipate coming in here pretty soon. Bob? I put in a minimum parking ratio for single room occupancy that we just did the SROs and you asked that question and I didn't put one in there. And then the more I thought about it, the more I was like, Bob is right. We should probably have at least a minimum so people have a sense of what it should be. And I included in your packet examples from a couple of cities in Oregon, Medford and Eugene, I believe.
Medford was stricter than this.
This was more aligned, I think, with Eugene's. You'll see that they'll be stricter or more lenient, and some of these codes you'll run into, and particularly in some of the larger jurisdictions, have min-max parking standards. So you have to fit within the parameters. You have to have at least, you know, X, but no more than Y, because they don't want over parking. This makes sense in terms of how it aligns with how we would apply the code. So, I mean, essentially, if you have a four-bedroom SRO, you're providing, which would be like a four-bedroom house, you're providing two off-street parking spaces, which is what we would require for a normal single-family detached house. This is the on-street parking credit that we talked about. I didn't make any changes from what you've seen in work session previously.
What are the odds that this is all going to be negated by the legislature?
Pretty high, but here's where I'd go with that. This logically makes sense. I think people, if you're a developer, you're going to gravitate towards doing something that the community's already signed off on versus doing something the community doesn't like. And I can't imagine you as a commission or the council is going to say, well, the council's already weighed in opposition to the adjustment language, and we would let people know that. And that's why I said after that bill gets passed, which it probably will, we're going to need to have a conversation about how we implement it. And we could disincentivize it. We can put stiffer fees on it. We could say, you don't get to take advantage of multiple unit property tax exemptions or other kind of incentives that we have because you're doing something we don't want to see. I mean, we can do that. It's whether or not you want to do it.
Right.
So I think there's value in it for those reasons. Then the adjustments has the, remember we, this, I don't, there's nothing new in here. It's the same language we talked about, which is the 10% we'll be able to do without a land use process and notice and that kind of thing. And then in the procedural piece, that's where we just captured that ministerial actions are ones with, that we have authority to handle as in our office. We had already defined ministerial. We just had never put it in the procedures piece as to, okay, who handles ministerial, and that's us. That's it.
Okay.
So I saw two things from the head nods around here. One, that you'd like the fire department to weigh in formally before council on the roadway width. And you
that
want...
That was your suggestion, not our suggestion.
Well, I suggested it, and I saw more than four people nod their heads yes.
That is correct.
So then that became your suggestion at that point.
Y'all.
Are you going to incorporate Ms. Connell's suggestion?
It's in there. I showed it to you.
Yeah, it's in there.
Yeah, it's already in. It's in the draft. Well, the 30 feet is in the draft.
30 days.
30 days.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
30 days.
30 days.
The 30, okay. 30 day versus month is in the draft.
Yes.
Yeah.
What's the second?
So you got me so stuck on roadways on like 30 feet.
You said there were two. No,
second one had to do with the trash receptacles being at least that 30 gallon, unless the unless basically Thompson's recommends larger.
Yeah. Okay.
The public hearing.
Any further discussion? Otherwise, what we need to do is have a motion to make a recommendation to the city council on the proposed amendments as to whether or not they are necessary and further the general welfare of the community.
So the public hearing's opened and closed because there's nobody here, right?
Right.
So I think I would agree with what the two recommendations are. So I'm okay with it.
Okay. Rolio.
I would prefer a more deliberative process. We've got, 131 pages. We got them Friday via email or today when we show up. And a lot of stuff to digest, a lot of issues. And I just would have preferred something a little more, say, deliberative before we make a decision. So I think this is kind of a rush. And so I would prefer more time to contemplate.
Well, do you want to make a motion?
No, I don't want to make a motion.
Okay, then I move that we forward file number 3-Z-23 to the city council with a favorable recommendation and the condition, the one condition of, well, the other one you were just going to change, weren't you?
Oh, yeah.
The garbage one, you're just going to change the language.
Yeah, but you could say that you want that change.
Okay. With the two change, with the change on the garbage receptacle language and the request to council to hear the fire chief's opinion on road widths.
Second.
Okay, we got a motion and a second. So all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? One nay? Okay. Motion carries.
You'll let us know if that permit request comes in.
When the permit come?
Yeah, for the
housing? I'm sorry?
For the RV thing. You said you had one in your pocket, but you hadn't submitted.
I was talking about housing.
Height.
The height. I was talking about the height.
Oh, the height one.
Height. It's part of this package, not an RV park.
Oh.
No, it's the apartment project.
Oh, I misunderstood.
Yeah, no, I have two of them that are waiting on the height issue. That's their issue.
They're looking for the 40 feet.
The 40 feet. That's helpful on their design.
Stories is that, four stories?
Three.
Three.
They were having, they've been having, and you saw it with the Windhaven adjustments coming in on those 10% adjustments. They just have a hard time, depending on the terrain they're dealing with, to get three full stories in with pitched roofs under 35 feet.
Okay. Any unfinished business director's comments or?
Oh, no, I think I've exhausted you guys tonight.
Okay.
Or vice versa.
Or vice versa.
More likely.
At 8:25, the regular session is ended.
All right. I'm going to be a grandma next time you guys see me.
Oh.